Daniel chapter 5, and for the last several weeks, we've been going through the book of Daniel, and we've been looking at the different lessons that the Lord has been teaching Nebuchadnezzar through these chapters and through the life of Daniel. And up until this point, in each chapter, chapter 1, 2, 3, and 4, the Lord taught Nebuchadnezzar a lesson and showed Nebuchadnezzar something about his character. And unfortunately, it took Nebuchadnezzar until chapter 4 before he finally got everything put together and came to the realization of who God is and who he is in relation to God. You know, God is the sovereign creator and controller of the universe, and he is not a respecter of persons. He gives to whom he will, and he takes from whom he wills. And so Nebuchadnezzar finally, at the end of chapter 4, he gets that right. Well, then we get to Daniel chapter 5, and we are introduced to a new character. And this is not Nebuchadnezzar, but this is Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, most likely, because there was a king, King Nabonidus, who was the king in between. And so in Daniel chapter 5, verse 1, we meet Belshazzar. And so it says, Belshazzar, the king, made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before the 1,000. And so just a little bit of background here. Belshazzar is a descendant of Nebuchadnezzar, right? Most likely his grandson. And he finds himself at the end of the Babylonian Empire, and he's being faced with the threat of the Medes and the Persians who are marching on Babylon. And if you recall from Daniel chapter 2, the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had about the statue with the different segments, right? Babylon was the head of gold, but what came next was the shoulder, the shoulders and the upper chest of, upper sternum of silver, who Daniel had said represented the Medes and the Persians. And so Nebuchadnezzar understood that eventually the empire of Babylon would give way to the empire of the Medes and the Persians. And so here Belshazzar finds himself at the end of the Babylonian Empire, and he's being faced with the threat of invasion by the Medes and the Persians, who at this time were marching on Babylon. And there are mixed accounts of exactly what's going on at this time, but the gist of it is that the Medes and the Persians are most likely right on his doorstep. They may have been a little ways away, but they're at least proverbially right on his doorstep, and there's a good chance that he's scared, all right? And so, you know, he doesn't necessarily know when everything's going to go down, but he knows that the Medes and the Persians are coming. He knows that the Empire of Babylon is under threat of invasion. And so what does he do in response to all of this? He throws a party. You guessed it, right? And so maybe this is a final fancy hoorah before they die. You know, maybe he's living in ignorance to the incoming invasion. You know, maybe he's just disregarding the severity of the situation because he's being cocky and he assumes that he's going to be fine. And any number of possibilities there. But what's significant is that he throws this great feast for 1,000 of his lords, and he drinks wine before the 1,000. And that number, 1,000, is probably just a hyperbole. It's not an exact number, but it's something that would just make reference to the fact that, like, there's just a bunch of them there. You know, we'd say, like, you know, oh, you know, the, you know, so-and-so, oh, they've got like a billion of those things. I mean, they don't literally have a billion of them, but we use that number as sort of a hyperbole just to say that there's a bunch of them. And so just that's just a little bit of what's going on here. Belshazzar's the king. He's under threat of invasion. He knows it's coming. And in the face of all of this, he gathers everybody together, and he throws a great big party. And then we read in verse 2, Belshazzar, whiles he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the golden and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, that the king and his princes, his wives, and his concubines might drink therein. And so we see that phrase, tasted the wine. And that is a reference to him being drunk. And so he gets drunk. And by the way, I don't want to hobby horse on this too much. But the manufacturing process of wine and alcohol has significantly developed since this time. And so processes exist now where wine and alcohol can be engineered with a much more concentrated alcoholic content. Whereas in this day and time, that would not have been the case as much. And so whereas, you know, these days, you know, someone, you know, might get drunk on as little as one or two or three, in those days, it would have taken far more. And so when it says that he was drunk, that took a lot, right? And that's also kind of in view in 1 Peter when he says, don't be drunk with wine, because that is excessive. But that's a conversation for another day. We can take that up another time. But the fact that he was drunk, that would have taken some doing. And so while he's drunk, he calls for the treasured vessels from the temple, which were taken during the original takeover of Judah. He calls for those to be brought so that he and all of his lords can drink out of them. And so we see in verses 3 and 4, then they brought the golden vessels, which were taken out of the temple of the house of God, which was at Jerusalem. And the king and his princes, his wives and his concubines drank in them. They drank wine. And while they drank wine, what do? They praised the gods of gold and of silver, of brass, of iron, of wood, and of stone. And so the vessels are brought, and the king and everyone starts drinking out of them. And they desecrate what these vessels represent, and they worship the gods of gold and silver, etc. Now, Babylon is a pagan empire, and so there would have been gods associated with, you know, fertility, weather, all that kind of stuff. And so it's possible when it says that they worship the gods of gold, silver, etc., it could be that those are specific gods, but really, as a whole, what are they doing? They're worshiping materialism. All right, they're praising stuff. Essentially, what they're doing is they're rubbing it in God's face. All right, by worshiping these gods of materialism, and by desecrating what these temple vessels represent, what they stand for. And this may seem kind of weird to us at first, especially since they are being faced with this threat of invasion from the Medes and Persians. You know, you think that this would be something that you would do at the height of your power, but they do it here just to kind of spite God, kind of mock him. It's possible that Belshazzar has some sort of understanding of the dream from chapter 2. And he's just kind of, you know, in your face to God, who was the giver of this dream. But whatever the case may be, it seems to fit the idea that Belshazzar really isn't taking this seriously. He's being very flippant. Perhaps he thinks he's invincible. Perhaps he's living in total ignorance. Like Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 2, he clearly believes that he's more powerful than God and that God is powerless to be able to affect him in any way. And so he's just being very flippant with these vessels and with their worship to the gods of materialism. And we see the response of God to all this in verse 5 and 6, where it says, in the same hour came forth fingers of a man's hand and wrote over against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. It says, then the king's countenance was changed. I love this. And his thoughts troubled him so that the joints of his loins were loosed and his knees smote one against the other. All right. And so, his knees started knocking, and it says that the joints of his loins were loosed.
And so that could be the idea of him being weak in the knees, or it could be something even more than that. But he's scared, right? And so while Belshazzar is in the process of shaking his fist at God, a hand appears and writes on the wall. And suffice it to say that he's scared silly, and he's physically trembling, right? It says that his knees were knocking against each other. And so what does he do in response to this? The king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers. And it's like, y'all, we've been looking at these guys for three chapters already. Like, have you not learned? Have you not learned that these guys are just a bunch of fakers? You know, have you not learned that these guys are just trying to play to the favor of the king to garner some power, some prestige for themselves? But nevertheless, he calls for him. The king spake and said to the wise men of Babylon, "Whomsoever shall read this writing and show me the interpretation thereof shall be clothed with scarlet." Scarlet would have been very, very expensive to make. "And have a chain of gold about his neck, and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." And so he calls all these fakers to interpret the writing for him, and he offers them reward. And this too seems to fit the idea of him really not taking his situation seriously, right? He's really not taking seriously the fact that he's under a serious threat from the Medes and the Persians. He either assumes himself to be invincible, or he's just totally ignorant, because by offering them this reward, he's assuming that his kingdom isn't going anywhere. He's assuming that his power and his prestige and his position is going to remain to the extent where he can actually make good on the reward, right? Like, I'm not going to offer you $1 million if I know that tomorrow my assets are going to be frozen, right? That's kind of pointless, or at the very least deceptive. And so he offers this reward to these fakers, this magic council, and we see their response to him in verse 8 and 9. It says, "Then came in all the king's wise men." No surprises here, but they could not read the writing. They found out what we already knew. They could not read the writing nor make known to the king the interpretation thereof. Then was the king Belshazzar greatly troubled, and his countenance was changed in him, and his lords were astonished. And so these fakers come in, and they can't interpret the dream. They can't interpret the message. They can't interpret the words. And Belshazzar is really unhappy about it. And there's a couple possible reasons as to why these fakers could not understand the message. It could be that this message was written in a language that none of them knew. I can read English, I can read French, I can read a good bit of Japanese, I've got Greek and Hebrew, but if you start writing in, you know, Russian, sorry, can't read it. You know, I mean, it could be my name, and I'm not going to know that that's my name because I can't read Russian, right? Or you could write it in, you know, Spanish, and I might be able to kind of deduce some of what it's saying. But, you know, if you were to write it in, you know, Zulu or Swahili, I don't know that language. I can't. I can't read it. I can't understand it. I can't decipher it. I can't explain it to you. You know, if you handed me a Bible that was, you know, written in, you know, Vietnamese or Korean, sorry, can't help you, right? And so it's possible that this message was written in a language that none of them knew. That's one possibility. A second possibility that has been proposed is that they weren't able to see the message, that this was a message that only Belshazzar could read, and for whatever reason, his comprehension failed, or this was a message that only he could see, and for some reason, his comprehension failed him. A third possibility, and the one that I believe in, is that there's a level of spiritual blindness to its meaning. This idea is often coupled with the notion that perhaps the words were written as like an anagram or an acrostic, or they were written in such a way that the words were obvious, but what the words meant was not apparent to them. And that's why their understanding failed them there. And so he calls in the fakers, the magic council. He says, hey, interpret this message. And if you do, there's all this reward for you. And the fakers say, I'm sorry, king, can't help you. Then we get to verse 10. And this should be a familiar scenario, because this has happened once already, where the fakers get called first and they can't help the king. And so then at the last, Daniel's called. But here we see in verse 10, now the queen, by reason of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banquet house. So she found out that the message was not interpreted. And so she comes in and she says, O king, live forever. Let not thy thoughts trouble thee, nor thy countenance be changed. Hey, king, don't stress out just yet. She says, there is a man in thy kingdom. And what's interesting is that that's the same phrase that we see in Daniel chapter 2. There is a man in thy kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods, and in the days of thy father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, was found in him, whom the king Nebuchadnezzar thy father, the king, I say, thy father, made master of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. For as much as an excellent spirit and knowledge and understanding, interpreting of dreams and showing of hard sentences and dissolving of doubts were found in the same Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar, now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation. And so the queen, who is most likely the queen mother here, she's the mother of Belshazzar, she comes in and she tells him about Daniel. And if like I said, if the words there are vaguely reminiscent, it's because Nebuchadnezzar describes Daniel the exact same way. Hey, there's this guy. He's got a special relationship with the gods. Turns out it's a special relationship with the God. And he can interpret dreams. And he is better and more skilled and more knowledgeable and more understanding and wiser than all these other fakers who are kind of pointless, right? And so she comes in and she goes, hey, here's this Daniel guy. Don't stress about the fact that the other guys couldn't help you. Call this Daniel guy. He'll help you out. In fact, he's so good that Nebuchadnezzar actually made him chief over all those other guys. And so what's interesting there, and I think I have a note about it somewhere else, but the fact that, you know, someone like the queen mother knew who Daniel was, knew that Daniel had been the chief among these other groups, but he's not now, evidences that either Nabonidus or Belshazzar had somehow discarded him at the changing of the kingdom there. And so that's interesting. I thought I had a note about it prior to this, but I guess I didn't. And so the queen says, hey, go get this Daniel guy. He can help you out. And so he calls him. Verse 13, then was Daniel brought in before the king, and the king spake and said unto Daniel, art thou that Daniel, which art of the children of the captivity of Judah, whom the king my father brought out of Jewry? I have even heard of thee, that the spirit of the gods is in thee, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom is found in thee. He says, and now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me, that they should read this writing and make known unto me the interpretation thereof, but they could not show the interpretation of the thing. He says, and I have heard of thee, that thou canst make interpretations and dissolve doubts. Now if thou canst read the writing and make known to me the interpretation thereof, thou shalt be clothed with scarlet, again, very expensive, and have a chain of gold about thy neck, and shalt be the third ruler in the kingdom. Now, here's what's interesting. All right, and maybe this is where I kind of made my note about that. You know, he addresses Daniel, he asks him to read this writing, and he promises him this power and this prestige and these possessions. And the thing about it is, these were things that under Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel had, right? If you will recall, it was either chapter three, I don't know, one of those chapters. Nebuchadnezzar actually promotes Daniel, right? And so when Belshazzar says, hey, I'll make you third ruler of my kingdom, Daniel's probably sitting there thinking, yeah, we've been there. We've done that, right? I know what you're talking about. And so Belshazzar, offers him all of this stuff that he likely had under Nebuchadnezzar, but he seemingly faded under either Nabonidus or Belshazzar himself had just kind of discarded him until now. But what's interesting is that we see Daniel's response to this offer from the king. Then Daniel answered and said before the king, let thy gifts be to thyself, and give thy rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing unto the king, and make known to him the interpretation. O thou king, the most high God gave Nebuchadnezzar thy father, All right, that's two separate verses there. He says, I will read the writing unto the king, and make known to him the interpretation. And so Daniel answers almost a little curtly, and he says, hey, you can keep your fancy stuff. I'm really not interested in having any of your niceties, you know, your scarlet and your gold and your position. I'm really not interested in any of that. But nevertheless, I'll still tell you what the inscription says. Hey, I don't want your stuff. Keep your stuff. But I'll tell you what the message says. And so he reveals the message. He says, O thou king, the most high God gave Nebuchadnezzar thy father a kingdom, and majesty, and glory, and honor. He says, and for the majesty that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him, whom he would he slew, and whom he would he kept alive, and whom he would he set up, and whom he would he put down. He says, but when his heart was lifted up, and his mind hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him, and he was driven from the sons of men, and his heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling place was with the wild asses or wild donkeys. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God ruled in the kingdom of men, and that he appointeth over it whomsoever he will. And so Daniel says, hey, you can keep your stuff, but I'll tell you the interpretation of the dream. Here's what's going on. Nebuchadnezzar, your grandfather, he was the king here, right? And he eventually got to a point where he was the grandest king of the grandest empire, but he was that way because God made him that way. Yet he failed to recognize that his position had come from God, and he allowed his heart to be lifted up with pride, and because of that, God deposed him. God took his kingdom away from him. He stripped him of his power. His men put him outside the city. He was completely humbled. I mean, like living in a field with no food and shelter. I mean, total humiliation, especially for someone like King Nebuchadnezzar. And God did that to him because God wanted him to understand who's in charge. God is in charge. And God takes the kingdoms of the world, and God gives it to whoever he wants to. And because God is the giver of power and prestige and possessions, God has the power to take them away. He gave them. He can take them back. And Nebuchadnezzar, your grandfather, he had to learn that lesson from God. And he did learn that lesson from God. And he continues on to say in verse 22, and thou his son, O Belshazzar, has not humbled thine heart, though thou knewest all of this. Hey, here's the history. Here's the reminder of your grandfather, King Nebuchadnezzar, and here's the deal. You knew all of this. All right, you know, as the king, as the grandson, you know this story. You know what happened with Grandpa. You grew up hearing this story about how Grandpa lived in a field for 7 years and why, and you should have known all this, right? You should have taken what you knew to be true, and you should have allowed it to determine what you do. Yet in spite of all of this, you have still rebelled against God's rule by desecrating these temple vessels. He goes on, but thou hast lifted up thyself against the Lord of heaven, and they have brought the vessels of this house before thee, and thou and thy lords, thy wives, and thy concubines have drunk wine in them. And thou hast praised the gods of silver and gold, of brass, iron, wood, and stone, which see not, nor hear, nor know. And the God in whose hand thy breath is, and whose are all thy ways, hast thou not glorified. He says in verse 24, then was the part of the hand sent from him, and this writing was written. Hey, king, you should have known better. You should have known better. Yet you still chose to openly rebel against God. You chose to act in open defiance of him. You have shaken your fist in his face. You have repeated the mistakes of Nebuchadnezzar, especially that phrase in verse 23 where he says, thou hast lifted up thyself against the Lord of heaven. That was something that Nebuchadnezzar did. He said, you did not learn from the mistakes of the past, but instead you have repeated them, arrogantly elevating yourself to position over God. And that's why God has taken his hand and God has written your fate out for you. And here's what it says. So we continue picking up in verse 25. He says, and this is the writing that was written. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. He says, this is the interpretation of the thing. Mene, God hath numbered thy kingdom and finished it. Tekel, thou art weighed in the balances and art found wanting. And then he says in verse 28, Pharez, the U there is just the and, so mene, mene, tekel, and farsin, and so farsin would be the plural of this word Pharez. It says, thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. And so the interpretation is based on a series of nouns, but more on verbs that are associated with those nouns. And so Daniel basically just draws the connection between the sign that has been given, this writing on the wall, and the doom, which is being prophesied by the writing on the wall. And so he really, in a lot of ways, demonstrates the skill that the queen mother had told of. And so really, in a lot of ways, his reputation precedes him, and he's able to, you know, make good on his skill there, whereas the others were not able to. And so he gives the puzzle, or he kind of breaks it down, this riddle and the meaning, right? And the gist of it is, you're done. The gist of this message is God is going to remove you from the throne. God is going to dissolve your kingdom, and you are going to die. In fact, you're going to die tonight. And what's interesting is we see Belshazzar's response to this very negative outlook, this very negative prophecy of his demise. And we see in verse 29, it says, then commanded Belshazzar, and they clothed Daniel with scarlet and put a chain of gold about his neck, and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. And so what's interesting is that in the face of this interpretation of this message, Belshazzar still gives Daniel the promised reward. And to be honest, at first, as I was reading this, I'm sitting there and I'm asking myself, well, why on earth would he do that? Like, you know, he, like Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar, they had a very special relationship, right? We see that in chapter 1, or we see that starting in chapter 1, we see that developing in chapter 2, and we really see that really play out in a positive way in chapter 4, when Daniel's able to just be really frank and really honest and really raw with Nebuchadnezzar. But Belshazzar and Daniel don't have that relationship, right? In at least one manner of speaking, Belshazzar and Daniel are interacting for the first time, perhaps ever, but at least for the first time in a very long time. And so there's really not that relationship there like there was with Nebuchadnezzar. And so it kind of makes me wonder, you know, in the face of such a negative prediction, you know, based on what we know to be true of Belshazzar, that he's just this arrogant, prideful, irresponsible king, why would he follow through on this promise? And I think there's a couple reasons. It could be, number one, you know, he's got to save face, right? Like, you know, I made a promise, and now I got to keep it, or I'm not going to look very good. You know, I didn't say you had to put a good spin on it. I just said you had to tell me what it means, and you told me what it means, so I guess I got to save face and make good. That's one interpretation. A second interpretation or second reason is that perhaps he's still being foolish, and perhaps he still thinks he's invincible. And so he's saying, okay, fine, I'm going to give Daniel all these things that I promised. And then, you know, based on, you know, okay, hey, I said, you know, interpret it, you interpreted it, I'm giving you all this stuff. And then when the interpretation that you gave doesn't come true, I get to strip you of all of it publicly, and I get to shame you. Hey, I honored this Daniel guy for his interpretation, but his interpretation didn't come true. And so it's possible that he's just being very arrogant. Now, I don't know that for a fact, but based on what I see of the character of Belshazzar in this passage, I think it's a good conclusion to say that he's still being very foolish, very irresponsible. Hey, I'm going to honor the reward and give it to you. And then when your prediction doesn't come true, I'm going to get to strip you of all of it publicly and shame you, which makes me look good. And so that's kind of where I'm at on that. But what's also weird is that we see no indication that Daniel refused the gift. And it could be that he didn't refuse it because he just thought, there's no point in refusing it. So he's just, you know, I'm not going to refuse it. There's no way that anybody could spin this to say that this was a bribe for a good report, because the report was not a good report. This reward is going to be short-lived anyways, because the kingdom is not going to be lasting. So we don't see any indication that Daniel refused the gift. But there is something that's also missing from this passage, right? We don't see any response from Daniel to this reward, and so that's missing from the passage. But there's another thing that's missing from the passage, and I think it's really, really sad. In Daniel 1, Daniel 2, Daniel 3, and Daniel 4, all four times when Nebuchadnezzar experienced the working of God in his life, he responded to that, didn't he? Now, granted, he didn't fully get it until chapter 4, but each time that Nebuchadnezzar had an experience with God, his response was to recognize, at least on some level, who God is. We don't see that here. And that's really sad. And so this this passage concludes on a very abrupt note. And for whatever reason, I don't have verse 30 and 31 up here, only verse 30. And so I'm not sure why I forgot verse 31. But this story ends very abruptly with verses 30 and 31. It says, "In that night was Belshazzar the king of the Chaldeans slain." It says, "And Darius the Median took the kingdom, being about 62 years old," or about 62 years old. And so this story ends quite abruptly, and essentially everything came true. Babylon goes out with a whimper. You know, some say that Babylon may have been under siege this whole time,
the Euphrates may have already been diverted away from the city, and the Medes may have, at the very moment that this party was going on, been tunneling into the city right under Belshazzar's nose. If that's the case, that's even worse. But Belshazzar the king falls that night. And history does tell us some about the fall of Babylon to the hands of the Medo-Persians. And so you can look that up later. But Babylon goes out with a whimper. Belshazzar's story is a one-off. He failed to learn from the mistakes of the past, and it resulted in the destruction of the Babylonian Empire. And so just a few things before we make our application, really just one thing. A commentator wrote sort of a summary of this passage, and I think it's really compelling, so I want to read it to you before we make our application. He says, Belshazzar in this chapter represents a vivid picture of the fool, the practicing atheist who at the end can only brazen it out with the help of alcohol, which blots out the stark reality. And so just a few applications, a few takeaways. Like Belshazzar, we need to understand that God does not take mockery lightly. You know, Belshazzar cared more about his fancy lifestyle than living for God or taking his role as the king seriously, and it cost him. Right? Galatians 6, 7, and 8, it says, be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. He says, he that soweth to his flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption. But he that soweth to the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap life everlasting. God doesn't take our mockery lightly. He says in James 4, which we'll get to in a couple weeks, he says, he, speaking of God, but he giveth more grace, wherefore he saith, God resisteth the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. And we saw that. We saw that in the life of Nebuchadnezzar, which means Belshazzar saw that in the life of Nebuchadnezzar. He would have heard that Nebuchadnezzar humbled himself before God. You know, we have in Daniel chapter 4, we have this letter, right? This letter from Nebuchadnezzar. Belshazzar would almost have certainly have at least been aware of that letter, if not read it himself. And so he knew better, but he chose to reject. He chose to make a mockery of God, and God does not take mockery lightly. The second thing that we need to understand, like Belshazzar, is that life is not about fancy things. Life is not about fancy things. A little bit of a longer passage here, but Proverbs 23, which is a passage that talks about this idea of fancy things. It says, when thou sittest to eat with a ruler, consider diligently what is before thee, and put a knife to thy throat, if thou be a man given to appetite. He says, be not desirous of his dainties, for they are deceitful meat. Labor not to be rich, cease from thine own wisdom. I'm going to skip a little bit. Actually, no, I'm not. He says, will thou set thine eyes upon that which is not? For riches certainly make themselves wings. They fly away as an eagle toward heaven. He says in verse 8, the morsel which thou hast eaten shalt thou vomit up and lose thy sweet words. And so we need to realize that life isn't about fancy things. Right? You know, the merriment, you know, it's all good and well, you know, getting together for Thanksgiving and eating way too much food. You know, that's all good and well, but that's not what life is about. And so we need to realize that life isn't about fancy things. And then the third thing that we need to realize, like Belshazzar, we need to learn from the mistakes of the past. Belshazzar was in a prime position to learn from the mistakes that Nebuchadnezzar made. But he chose not to. He chose to reject them. He chose to suppress them. Either he or Nabonidus before him had removed Daniel from his position. And so Belshazzar had full and sufficient opportunity to learn from Nebuchadnezzar's mistakes, but he didn't. Proverbs 23, that same passage, a little bit later on, he says, remove not the old landmark and enter not into the fields of the fatherless, for their Redeemer is mighty. He shall plead their cause with thee. He says, apply thine heart unto instruction and thine ears to the words of knowledge. He says, withhold not correction from the child, for if thou beatest him with the rod, he shall not die. Thou shalt beat him with the rod and shall deliver his soul from hell. Now, my kids hate that passage, but it's a good passage because here's the thing. Why do we discipline our children? Is it because we're mean and we're vindictive and we just want them to feel our wrath? No, why do we discipline our children? Because we want them to learn that actions have consequences. And bad actions have bad consequences. You know, I remember, it was probably 2-3 years ago now, there was a kid up at Westgate where I was youth pastor in the school, and he was constantly in trouble. He's still constantly in trouble, to be honest with you. I'm genuinely surprised that he's still at the school. But anyways, he was in the office, which was a pretty normal occurrence, and he was mad because he didn't want to be there. And so he was pitching a little fit, and I don't remember what he was going to get, but it was a handful of demerits, and he was mad about it because he didn't want the demerits. He didn't want to get the demerits. He deserved them. He knew he deserved them, but he just didn't want them. And so he was pitching a fit about getting a couple of demerits for whatever it is that he had done. And so I go into the office to either get something from my mailbox or get something off the printer. I don't remember why I was in there. But I was in there, and he's pitching a fit. And I finally turned to the school secretary, and I said, Mrs. Hoyt, do you ever wish you could just get 5 demerits and move on? She's like, oh, every day. And this kid, he kind of perks up a little bit. I says, you know, there are days where I just wish I could get 5 demerits and move on. You know, and then I turned to him. I said, you know, his name is Ben. I said, you know, Ben, today it's 5 demerits. I said, when you get to be my age, it could be your job. It could be your marriage. It could be a car accident that costs somebody's life. I said, right now, bad choices result in 5 demerits. When you get to be my age, the consequences are far, far worse. I said, so my advice to you, take the demerits and learn your lesson. It will be better for you in the long run. And he still didn't like it, but I walked out of the room and I knew I was right. And he stopped pitching a fit about it. So, mission successful there. But we need to learn from the mistakes of the past. You know, disciplining children, it's uncomfortable. It's certainly uncomfortable for them. It's uncomfortable for us, or at least it should be. Right? If we enjoy disciplining our children, there's a problem there that needs to be addressed. There are times, a lot of times, where I have to wait a little bit before I discipline my kids because I don't enjoy it. Right? And I need to get myself in the right frame of mind to be able to do it. But the whole point here is you got to learn from the mistakes of the past. And if you don't learn from the mistakes of the past, they will cost you more and more and more each time. How many of us would say there are days where I just wish I could get 5 demerits and move on? Like, yeah, I wish. But that's not the way it works. Proverbs chapter 1, we'll read these verses quickly. He says, turn you at my reproof. Behold, I will pour out my spirit unto you. I will make known my words unto you. By the way, Proverbs is all about wisdom. That's why we're reading a lot of it here in the context of this. He says, because I have called and ye refused, I have stretched out my hand and no man regarded. But ye have set at naught all my counsel and would none of my reproof. I also will laugh at your calamity. I will mock when your fear cometh. When your fear cometh as desolation and your destruction cometh as a whirlwind, when distress and anguish cometh upon you, then shall they call upon me, but I will not answer. They shall seek me early, but they shall not find me. For that they hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of the Lord, they would none of my counsel, they despised all my reproof. Therefore shall they eat of the fruit of their own way and be filled with their own devices. What
is, I think you guys are going to get this. What is the worst thing that God could ever do to me? Let me have my own way. You know, that's exactly what happened to Belshazzar. He shook his fist in God's face and said, and God said, okay, have it your way. And the worst thing that God could ever do to me is let me have my way. Because you know what I'm going to do every single time? I'm going to destroy myself. And so when God gives me 5 demerits, thank you, Lord, I'm going to learn my lesson. And Belshazzar didn't learn his lesson, but we have an opportunity to learn our lesson from Belshazzar. So let's do that.